Our second case this morning is United States against Maynard. Counsel for the defense, you may proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Captain William Jeremy Stevens, along with my co-counsel, Colonel Christopher O'Brien, who represents the appellant in this matter, Specialist Robert Maynard, Jr. In this case, the military judge committed plain error when he allowed the members to consider appellant's alleged anti-war and anti-American beliefs as aggravation evidence following appellant's conviction for a single specification of a law. Appellant's alleged anti-war and anti-American beliefs are not proper aggravation evidence under RCM 1001-B4, and therefore their admission greatly prejudices the substantial rights of the appellant. At its core, aggravation evidence must make something more serious and more severe than it otherwise would be. Appellant's alleged anti-war and anti-American beliefs do not make his offense of AWOL any more worse than it already is. To be admitted as proper aggravation evidence, the proffered evidence must directly relate to or result from convicted offenses. Here, the proffered evidence does not directly relate to nor result from the offenses for which the appellant was convicted.
Would you consider that his unsworn statement, where he talked about his mental problems as a cause for him leaving, was that proper mitigation evidence?
His unsworn statements regarding the
reasons that he had trouble making decisions and he was under stress and he had these mental things, and presumably that was his testimony in mitigation.
Yes, Judge, we would agree that would be proper mitigation.
So then why isn't it proper that this would be evidence in aggravation as another alternative reason for why he went AWOL?
It's important to note that the trial counsel never argued this was a reason the soldier went AWOL. The evidence was simply brought out to show the appellant was a bad guy. The trial counsel never drew the distinction or any portion of their case in aggravation that appellant went AWOL because he professed these beliefs, because he was a Fahrenheit 9/11 fan, because he said the commander-in-chief called President Bush a liar. That direct relationship is missing in this case. You know, it was never drawn by the trial counsel. And that portion of the 1001-B4 analysis.
Well, didn't he come pretty close to it, though? Didn't he infer that in his closing arguments when he said the accused, you know, he said that he never went further than that in making those political statements to Nelson? But we know that's not true. We know that he went AWOL, and then he left something behind in his room that says otherwise.
We would concede that is the argument of the trial counsel during closing. However, there's no evidence ever pointing to this is why the appellant went AWOL. The argument that trial counsel is making is obviously not evidence, but there was never any evidence drawn by the trial counsel stating appellant went AWOL because he was anti-American, because he held these beliefs. There are no witnesses who stated appellant told me he was anti-American, appellant told me he was anti-war, and that was why he went AWOL.
If in fact it is a matter of law, if in fact would the reason someone went AWOL be appropriate aggravating evidence?
Judge Baker, your question goes to motive. And yes, as a matter of law, motive is directly related to the offense. But what's key here is that this is far too speculative to be shown as motive. The trial counsel never draws the link.
What about the first sergeant's testimony saying that when they went in the room, there's no civilian clothing and there was a display? Now, I don't know what that means, but a display sounds like something that's more than your laundry on the floor. It sounds like something that's been set up to communicate a message.
Judge Baker, I totally disagree that anything was left to communicate a message. However, First Sergeant Guerrero does use the word display, and we're unclear from the record what exactly this was in the room. It could mean it was a piece of paper left on a desk. It could be it was a bulletin board left in the phone's room. We simply don't know from the record.
But this is a plain error context, right? So could it be read that way?
It could not be read that way, Your Honor, because there's still no direct relationship to the offense. It's still not shown that that's the motive as to why you may want it. And the motive is there because the motive is what makes it directly related to the offense. Otherwise, it's just evidence of the soldier's a bad guy, punish him more because he has this thought.
But if he's set up for display, perhaps he's sending a message.
There's no evidence he's sending a message, though. There's no evidence that anyone else heard a message. There's no evidence he intended this message to hear anyone else. In fact, when he took the stand during
So in your view, that's not an available inference from the first sergeant's testimony?
It's not at all available inference, Your Honor.
Is this 1001B4 at all?
I'm sorry, I couldn't understand.
Is this 1001B4 at all?
No, Judge Stuckey, it's not, for the simple reason that it's not shown to be directly related to the offense.
Is it uncharged misconduct?
We're not conceding at all that it's even misconduct.
That's what I'm getting at.
It's not.
Is political expression misconduct?
No, it's not.
Okay.
Counsel, in this case, we have testimony that's been described. We have the trial counsel's argument. And then we had the military judge's instruction to consider, give due consideration to all matters. Where's the error in this case? What's the specific error?
The error in this case was the military judge not sua sponte stopping the defense witness when he testified as to the phrasing of anti-war, anti-American very beginning, and telling the members at that point, you may not consider blank. You may not.
So it was an error for the judge to instruct on considering all evidence after the defense counsel objected?
I'm sorry, I'm pretty confident.
Was it not error, in your view, for the judge to instruct the members to give consideration to all evidence after the defense counsel objected to the trial counsel's closing argument?
The instruction by the military judge, while he obviously instructed you may consider all evidence in aggravation, didn't go far enough in the defense's view, because it needs to tell the members you may not consider X, Y, or Z. And that's,
what's your answer to my question? Was it error or was it not error for the judge to give that instruction after the defense counsel objected?
In that sense, it was error.
Then why are we in a plain error context in this case?
Why are we in plain error context? Because the evidence was already before the members at that point.
Well, if the judge erred in giving the instruction, what difference does it make whether the evidence was before the members or not? When there's evidence in a case, that doesn't relieve the judge of the responsibility of responding to an objection or giving a proper instruction, does it?
That's correct.
Okay. So I have no further questions on that.
Can you point in the record where the judge crossed the sui sponte tripwire?
I'm not sure I understand your question, Mr. Speaker.
At what point in the record do you believe in the back and forth? You just said the judge had a sui sponte duty. When did that arise? It can't arise in the 900th page. It has to arise at a particular point. When was that tripwire?
When First Sergeant Guerrero discusses what was found in the appellant's room, discussing anti-war material, anti-American propaganda, Fahrenheit 9/11 material that's left in the room, that is not directly related to the offense in that point.
So it's in that page in the record that the judge should have done what?
I believe at that point he should have told the members, you may not consider this is not proper aggravation evidence. It may not be considered by you in the deliberation of the sentencing. Mm-hmm. I believe that's page 110. Last year, this court was clear in U.S. v. Hardison, holding that directly related.
I'm sorry, I
apologize.
So when the first sergeant says some of it was TA-50 military issue gear, and on the three-drawer chest, I identify a display of personal items, one being a pin, blah 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 blah. That's when the judge should have said, "Hang on there, first sergeant."
Yes, sir.
That's
yes. I apologize. Last year, this court was clear in U.S. v. Hardison, holding that directly related evidence must be directly related in time, type, and/or often outcome. Here, the evidence of appellate's social and political beliefs, anti-war and anti-American beliefs, is even further removed than what this court saw in U.S. v. Hardison.
Well, Hardison had a problem with time.
Yes, sir.
There's no problem with time here.
There's no problem with time, however. What the key problem here is that, unlike Hardison, there's a big problem with type.
Okay, well, that leads to my question. Should arguably constitutionally protected speech be considered qualitatively different for admission purposes in situations like this than evidence, say, of previous drug use or stuff of that sort in this context?
In the context of 1001B?
Yeah.
I think the key before any evidence at all gets in, it has to be shown to be directly related. I think that's the
right. Story. But assuming arguendo, you get past that gate. You know, the government is arguing it shows motive. Let's say arguendo, it might show motive. Should it be, because of its nature, treated differently once you get past the directly related gate? And that's policy question.
I think it's a mixed
question of policy and constitution.
And I think on the specific facts of this case, I think it's important, yes, and it should be treated differently because the display was only in his room. There's no evidence here he was running up and down the halls, no evidence even when he was AWOL he was holding any sort of anti-American, anti-war rallies or anything like that. He was not a soldier asking other soldiers to join him as he went AWOL or anything of that nature. This is qualitatively different, Your Honor.
Counsel, can I go back to the question of what the error is that you're alleging? Is the error, as you initially framed it, that the military judge didn't sua sponte stop the witnesses from testifying about these matters? Was the error in not holding that the trial counsel's argument was improper? Or was the error in not instructing the members to disregard the trial counsel's argument? Or is it something else?
And I believe I got confused really when I answered Judge Efron's question. The error here is when he doesn't stop First Sergeant Guerrero, when he doesn't at that point say, members, you may not consider this. That is where the error is, and I apologize if I misstated it earlier. That is where the error is.
Thank you.
It's important to note the provision of 1001b4 is set up even through its terms to go to unit and victim impact statements, various hate crime situations, none of which exist here. Statements relating to Appellant's alleged anti-war, anti-American beliefs do nothing more than inflame the members. They add nothing to the case, and they are not directly related to the case. Throughout, the military judge himself also termed this as evidence of aggravation, as did the trial counsel. In fact, throughout the argument, and even during the third and eighth session between the two, the trial counsel pointedly states, let's get the language right, the facts and circumstances of this case go to the aggravation of that AWOL, and the aggravation directly resulted from that AWOL. The trial counsel himself is arguing this throughout as this material, this proper evidence being aggravation, not being any sort of evidence other than aggravation. The error here was clear and obvious. In light of 1001b4 and the cases that have since supported that, Wiener, Gordon, Rust, and last year's case at Hardison, all those cases discussed directly related, in light of those cases, the error here by the military judge was clear. In Hardison, the admission of the challenge evidence, the admission of the proper aggravation evidence on its face, satisfied the first two prongs of the plain error analysis, which would also occur in this case.
Counsel, does it help you or hurt you that the military judge in this case instructed the members that they must bear in mind that the accused is to be sentenced only for the offense for which he was charged? Of which he was found guilty. Or does it matter?
I'm not sure it matters, Your Honor. I think it would have obviously helped if he had said, you may not consider this. I'm not sure what he said helped or hurt at that point, because I think the members are already under the standing we're here to sentence the appellant for what he's been found guilty of. I'm not sure if the judges may only sentence him for what he's been found guilty of. I'm not sure if it helped or hurt that.
Well, I mean, if we're looking at this under a plain error analysis, right, and we're looking to see, you know, whether there was error and whether there was prejudice, if the members are instructed that he's only to be sentenced for what he was found guilty of, even though they can consider the matters an extenuation and mitigation, don't we assume that they followed that instruction and only sentenced him for the AWOL?
I'm not sure we can assume that based on the pervasive nature of the appellant's arguing the anti-war materials found in the room. During the argument, trial counsel is stating several times there was anti-war material in his room. Rather than ever relating it to the offense, he's going back to saying this is a bad soldier, this is a bad guy. He should be arguing that at the end of trial counsel's argument, he pushes for the maximum sentence.
Well, see, now you're back to arguing, to basically focusing on the trial counsel's argument as opposed to what you say the error was here, which is that the military judge didn't sua sponte interrupt the first sergeant when he was testifying, which... is it?
It was the first one. I apologize, but I picked up on the prejudice nature of your question. This is just going to more pounding it in the members' heads. They're hearing this again. Yes, they're hearing the military judge say, sentence him only for what he's convicted of. And we got he was convicted for the AWOL, but yet we've heard all this other bad stuff about him before that nobody told us we couldn't consider.
But, I mean, didn't the defense counsel argue that the reason he went AWOL was because he was depressed and all of these things were going on in his personal life, right?
Yes, the defense counsel did that after the trial counsel had put forth this presentation of anti-war and anti-American material. That did come out by the defense counsel, yes.
Well, I mean, the appellant did testify in an unsworn statement and say all these things, right?
He did make his unsworn statement, yes. Yes, Your Honor.
Well, are you taking a different position than the trial defense counsel did? As I read the record, the trial defense counsel found that the error was when the judge allowed the trial counsel to make the argument.
The trial, Your Honor, quite frankly, that's why we're here on a plain error analysis, because the trial defense counsel did not object at that time when the witness made these statements. We are taking a different argument, yes, than the trial defense counsel, because he did not properly object. During the objection the trial defense counsel made following trial counsel's argument in the 38A, it went to, yes, trial counsel's made a proper argument. The appellant's position is that the improper argument is based on improper aggravation evidence, which should have never been in, and that was where the error came in, was the improper aggravation evidence in the first place, which is just amplified there in the members' minds after that.
I would have thought that your argument would have been the one that Judge Efron is not making but is asking you about, which is that this isn't a plain error case, that this was preserved error, and that the error was in trial counsel's argument and in the military judge's failure to tell the members to disregard it. It was improper argument.
We did not argue that point in our brief, Your Honor. However, we would agree that the trial counsel's argument comes improper when he uses the improper aggravation evidence. In this case, to briefly conclude, the military judge erred by allowing admission of the appellant's alleged anti-war and anti-American beliefs as improper aggravation evidence during the sentencing. The substantial prejudice caused by this error demands that the sentence in this case be set aside and this court order is set as we agree. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Captain Michael Pond, along with Colonel John Miller, I represent the United States in this appeal. The military judge did not commit any error, let alone plain error, in admitting the testimony of First Sergeant Guerrero and Staff Sergeant Nelson. First Sergeant Guerrero's testimony rebutted previously admitted defense exhibits, which suggested a sympathetic motive for appellant's AWOL. It was also proper aggravation evidence directly relating to the charge of offense. Regarding Staff Sergeant Nelson, the government cross-examination properly tested the basis of his opinion that appellant was a good soldier who should be allowed to return to the unit and was therefore for directly on his rehabilitative potential.
Is holding unpopular political opinions not being a good soldier?
No, Your Honor, but that's not why. Why it was relevant. It was relevant because, and this gets us into 1001C and 1001B5D, but as you know, the defense...
Is this 1001B4?
In terms of whether...
Is this fit within 1001B4's aggravation?
Staff Sergeant Nelson's testimony?
I'm talking about, Guerrero.
Yes, and it's important to disaggregate the two,
okay,
because we are not asserting, or at least it's a weaker argument, that Staff Sergeant Nelson's conversations with the accused 2 years later were aggravation evidence.
Mm-hmm. Now I'm talking about Guerrero.
Yes. Okay. That was both rebuttal evidence, proper rebuttal evidence, and aggravation evidence, and I can address them in whichever order you
want. Go ahead. My first question, which is, you said it's to rebut good soldier defense.
What we stated was that First Sergeant Guerrero's testimony rebutted previously admitted defense exhibits, which suggested a sympathetic motive for appellant's AWOL.
Mm-hmm.
The two letters that were admitted before the members were seated, and under United States v. Blade, that constituted the government's response to that, even though it came in on the government's case in chief during sentencing, it constituted rebuttal evidence.
Would that be true if they rummaged through his locker and found this in a trunk?
It would be much less probative because the testimony of First Sergeant Guerrero was that he removed basically all his other personal items, leaving only this display. The inference which the panel could draw was that it was intended as a deliberate message to those who would come after. That inference would be much less powerful if it was mixed up amongst other personal items. Now, the defense could certainly argue that, but that goes to weight, not admissibility.
One of the great virtues of the United States military, or at least George Marshall's military, is its nonpartisan character, which has been emphasized by some of the greats in the Army in particular. Appellant argues that the military judge had a sui sponte duty to do something when the first sergeant started talking about this person's apparent political views. Shouldn't the military judge in our military system have at least made an inquiry at that point as to what was going on so that he could at least have asked the government what's the purpose of this testimony. Approach the bench and tell me what you're up to here. Do something. This is, this is not random stuff where you're not sure what it has to do with what. This stands out in a military context, in our military context. What's your response to that?
Your Honor, our response would be that the relevance of First Sergeant Guerrero's testimony regarding the display, the military judge was aware of what the defense had admitted. Although it's not, there's no explicit findings on the record because the defense failed to object. It was proper rebuttal evidence and it was also proper aggravation evidence. We do not assert that the military judge had any sua sponte duty to respond at that point. In our adversarial system, the burden is on the defense counsel. This is not a defense counsel. We would note that was asleep at the switch. The very next page after that testimony, he objects. That objection is sustained. So, again, there's no IAC claim here, nor does it seem warranted based on the idea that the defense counsel was sleeping. For whatever reason, they chose not to object. The testimony was relevant. It was admissible. Or directly on the accused motive of Hardison. And this was contemporaneous.
Hardison held that evidence of pre-enlistment drug use was not proper aggravation in a drug case.
Roger.
Because of the temporal difference. If pre-enlistment drug use is not proper aggravation in a drug case, how can evidence of one's political opinions be proper aggravation evidence in an AWOL case?
Your Honor, the evidence was not of his political opinions as such.
What was it of?
The evidence was that when he abandoned his unit, he did so for reasons which were contrary to those asserted by the defense, namely his systemic disorder and his anxiety. And that was an inference that was directly drawn, or a point that was directly made in Defense Exhibit A. She didn't just say he has an anxiety problem. She said he had an escalating anxiety problem which caused him this final time to choose another life. The government evidence, First Sergeant Guerrero's testimony was directly relevant to rebut that. The defense had its opportunity to explain, give its side of why appellant went AWOL. It's only fair that the government was entitled to put a lie to the defense's sentencing evidence and say,
he went AWOL because he's a bad guy and he holds unpopular political opinions.
No, Your Honor.
He went AWOL why?
He went AWOL because, A, he hated his job, as he stated, and apparently he had some problem with Bush, the commander-in-chief. So,
counsel, would you agree that your argument is stronger, that this evidence was proper rebuttal evidence as opposed to the argument that this evidence was proper aggravation evidence?
Short answer, Your Honor, yes, I do agree, although I think they're both strong. I think any time you have the defense opening a door by submitting its own motive evidence in extenuation, it's going to be easier to argue rebuttal, but I think in this case they're both fairly strong.
And in that regard, how did the trial counsel in the case identify this as rebuttal evidence in his argument?
Your Honor, the trial counsel, I don't think the trial counsel ever explicitly identified it as rebuttal evidence.
Right. So are we in a posture here where after the fact, we're going to be looking at this and trying to justify it as rebuttal evidence as opposed to the trial counsel of the case saying the defense argues X as the reason for the AWOL, but this evidence rebuts it?
Your Honor, if I may be appellant supplementally cited a case which bears directly on your question, if we may it'll answer both questions if I respond. The proposition the defense posited in its supplemental cite was that, and I believe this was, I forget the cite on me, but evidence accepted at trial for one purpose may not be used by an appellate tribunal as though admitted for a different purpose. That case, this case falls outside that rule, and it's this court is not constrained in the way it was constrained in that case because, in this case, the military judge did not admit the evidence for any particular purpose, and he did not instruct the panel to limit its consideration of the evidence for any particular purpose, which was later found to be erroneous. In this case, because the defense failed to object, the military judge's explanation in the 39A session was entirely superfluous. As there have been, under 103, there have been no timely objections when the evidence came out during the trial. And even during the 39A session, the defense, while expressing concern, explicitly stated it did not object.
Yeah, counsel, my question was not whether, as a matter of law, we can retrospectively determine that evidence was admissible for another reason. My question was, on the record in this case, did the prosecution offer this evidence to rebut any specific testimony by the defense?
Yes. And again, I apologize, Your Honor, I was talking about First Sergeant Barrera's testimony, but it was Staff Sergeant Nelson's testimony. They did offer it to rebut that in the sense that the accused posited that I believe I have the page. Right, and this is the record of 134. Appellants claim that his political views went no further than conversation. Now, Staff Sergeant Nelson's, the government noted in its sentencing argument that indeed they did go further than conversation.
No, I understand that. They're rebutting this whole political debate. But with respect to the offense, the rationale for going AWOL, did this political testimony rebut anything? I understand your post hoc argument. Did the prosecution argue that the political testimony rebutted anything that was said about his rationale for going AWOL?
Just make sure I've got this right.
Okay. Let me try just so I can get the. At the trial, did the defense offer a rationale for going AWOL that the prosecution then rebutted by introducing the political evidence?
Yes.
Okay.
And that's
your argument. Now, then my next question is, did the prosecution at the time say that we are offering this evidence to rebut his rationale for going AWOL?
No, and the reason they did not is because the defense never objected.
And isn't that the problem, counsel, which is that ordinarily in sentencing cases under the military justice system, sentencing evidence is presented, and unless there is an objection, you don't state the grounds for which you're offering it, right?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
But here isn't what you call the rebuttal evidence being admitted before the reasons were given in his unsworn statement as to why he went AWOL?
Yes, Your Honor. But
how do you even know he was going to make that statement?
First Sergeant Barrera's testimony's relevance does not depend on the hope that the accused will later make an unsworn statement.
Well, then how can it be in rebuttal?
Because under United States v. Blake, this court resolved that question. In that case, the defense introduced exhibits before the members were seated, and the prosecution, during its case-in-chief on rebuttal, rebutted that previously admitted testimony. And the question before this court was...
So this wasn't rebuttal as to the reasons for going AWOL. This was rebuttal to the good soldier package. Is that your position?
But, Your Honor, that packet, the two exhibits in that packet, posited a motive why appellant went AWOL. Appellant was asserting that, or at least it was an inference, that he was asking the panel to draw, that it was his anxiety that caused him to go AWOL. Once that went into evidence, it became fair game for the prosecution to rebut that. The prosecution didn't have to wait for its real rebuttal case procedurally. It could, in its case in chief on sentencing, rebut the motive asserted by the defense, the extenuating.
Are you talking about the mother's letter, the fiancé's mother's letter?
The fiancé-to-be, yes, Your Honor, and the diagnosis of the seventh disorder, but mainly the letter.
And it's the government's view that by making these statements, that justifies asking members for a greater sentence than if it was mental problems.
The accused, not the statements themselves, Your Honor, but inasmuch as they showed that the accused his motive for going AWOL was...
His possible motive for going AWOL.
Possible. Motive for going AWOL was unsympathetic. And just as the accused can certainly get up or introduce evidence that he had a family crisis or something like that, that's extenuating. The members could say, well, he deserves a lesser sentence for that. Similarly, the government may introduce evidence that shows that he went AWOL for selfish reasons, and he abandoned his comrades, things like that, which would tend to aggravate his AWOL because of him.
And where exactly does the I hate Bush, the commander-in-chief, statement fall into this?
Well, inasmuch as it, in two ways, again, it rebuts what he's already, what the public has already asserted, and it is also directly related to the offense and aggravation, because it shows that he doesn't have a very, we want to be careful, because we don't want to start saying that anyone who disagrees with the commander-in-chief, well, that's aggravation evidence.
Well, but aren't you saying that anyone who disagrees with the commander-in-chief isn't a good soldier? You're rebutting the good soldier defense with Nelson's testimony?
In a sense, Your Honor, I mean...
In a sense, that's exactly what you're doing. You're saying that to hold unpopular political opinions makes one, is proper rebuttal evidence to a good soldier defense.
And proper aggravation. It's very important to note that what appellant, the display that he made...
I'm talking about Nelson now.
Okay, Your Honor. Because I was talking about, I just want to highlight the fact that he said, I hit the commander-in-chief. So this was a military context. He was not speaking...
Well, he's speaking privately. Now, we can go all... Of course, he's not a commissioned officer, so we don't drag contemptuous words in there. You know, one can argue about whether that's contemptuous, but leave that aside. Go ahead.
And again, just so to make sure I understand your question regarding Staff Sergeant Nelson.
My question is it proper aggravation, a proper rebuttal to a good soldier defense to show that one holds unpopular political opinions?
No, and I think this well...
Isn't that what you do? Isn't that what they did here?
If I may explain, this court's decision in United States v. Hill illustrates the point that the government is trying
United
to
States
make.
V. Hill. Hill, okay.
That the government is trying to make, or at least the procedural posture, regarding Staff Sergeant Nelson's testimony. In Hill, the defense called the accused battalion commander to testify on sentencing. Now, under the latitude afforded the defense under 1001C, the battalion commander was allowed to state whether he would accept appellant back into his battalion, which is something the prosecution cannot do under 1001D. And this court stated, once the defense opened the door to the issue of whether the battalion commander would want appellant back in the unit, the prosecution appropriately sought to explore the witness's response on cross-examination by addressing the desirability of retaining in the unit a person who had committed those offenses. That's what happened here.
But that's not this situation. You're saying, do you want this guy back in the unit? If you had said, do you want this guy back in the unit after he went AWOL, that would be Hill. You're not saying that. You said, do you want this guy back in the union because he holds these opinions?
No, I'm sorry. Your Honor. What the defense counsel elicited, the opinion that he elicited, Staff Sergeant Nelson was that Staff Sergeant Nelson would love to retain him in the
right.
That then opened the door for the trial counsel to explore the wisdom or desirability of retaining in the unit appellant, and therefore he was allowed to ask.
So he has carte blanche to probe in his political opinions. I'll ask you the same question I asked the appellant, which is, ought arguably constitutionally protected expression be treated any differently from evidence of prior drug use or what have you as evidence in aggravation? Let's jump back to aggravation.
No, Your Honor. There's no compelling reason to do that. And the Supreme Court and the Federal Circuits have made it clear that the First Amendment does not erect a per se barrier to admission at sentencing of evidence regarding the defendant's beliefs. The corollary to that is that the sentencing court may consider such evidence so long as it is, quote, relevant to the issues involved in the sentencing proceeding. That's Dawson. And then we also cite Kane for the proposition that the First Amendment does not bar the government from putting the lie to the defendant to prove the sentence. And that is, so the question under Dawson is, okay, how was the testimony relevant to the issues involved in the sentencing proceeding? Here, it was relevant to rebuttal. It was relevant to motive. The motive, we cite Barclay. arguably relevant to likelihood of recidivism, which is also Cain. So these are issues that were relevant to the issues that were raised either by appellant or directly relevant to in aggravation. And therefore, the First Amendment does not bar them so long as they are relevant. Now, you want to get into how the defense objected, get into 403 and that sort of thing. There may be circumstances.
Why aren't we there? Why aren't we there? In this case, the defense counsel, immediately upon conclusion of the argument, objected. And the military judge had in the 39A session, and the defense counsel said, what kind of position am I in now? Now I have to give you an instruction to correct this that's going to affect this even more. If I do what you want me to do, military judge, and give you an instruction about telling the members to disregard this, this is going to wave a banner in front of the members. Why doesn't that underscore the sua sponte duty of the judge to intervene? And I recognize you're not. This is assuming error here. If there's no error, that is, if it's all relevant, this isn't a problem. But if this is not admissible testimony, and we're talking about the error context. Why doesn't that underscore the error in this case when you have the defense counsel objection at that point?
Your Honor, first and foremost, the defense never objected. They explicitly said during that session you're talking about, we do not object to the testimony at this time.
I'm not talking about the testimony. I'm talking about the trial counsel's argument.
We do not want to object to it at this time. Record at 178. All the defense counsel did was express concern, which is not an objection.
Because the defense counsel is saying at that point, you can't help me anymore.
Well, then there's two responses to that, Your Honor. One is, where was he when the testimony came out and he had an opportunity to object? The second point is, well, make a belated objection. It may not work. On appeal, but I mean, at the very least, I mean, if he has that much of a problem with this.
Okay, so your view of the 39A session and the defense counsel's problem at that point is it's waived at that point.
It's
an express waiver. Okay.
In fact, so that's what the military judge said. He may have given an explanation, but it was not a ruling on that issue because it was waived.
Didn't the defense counsel say at record 178 he didn't object in open court because he was concerned an emphasis would place undue emphasis on the remarks?
The question would be, does that matter? I mean, if he wants to object and get a limiting instruction, he's got to object.
So defense counsel, in your view, forfeits any concern about sua sponte responsibility on the top of responsibility of the military judge when the defense counsel makes a tactical decision that to object on an open court or to request an instruction would accentuate the problem.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
There's just a few points we'd like to highlight briefly.
We gave the defense a bit more time, so if you could briefly make those points and then sum up, that would be fine.
Just on the prejudice issue, we'd just like to highlight just a few points very quickly. One, as this court's aware, the military judge, unlike Carson, did give a limiting instruction. Second, the trial counsel's argument did not focus on this testimony at all. The references were oblique, indirect, and related to other matters. This was not a trial counsel who was using this as a hammer. So it certainly doesn't support the idea that the trial counsel was trying to improperly focus panel members on the political beliefs. It certainly doesn't rise to the level of Schroeder or Barraza Martinez, which we subcited. Not in neither of which cases this court found plain error. I will briefly conclude. The military judge did not commit any error, let alone plain error, in admitting the testimony of First Sergeant Pereira and Staff Sergeant Nelson. Their testimony rebutted appellant's benign explanation for his unlawful absence and fairly attacked the suggestion that he be returned to the unit. The danger of unfair prejudice in this case was low due to the trial counsel's restrained handling of the evidence and the military judge's limiting instruction. Accordingly, this court should affirm the decision of the Army Court of Criminal Appeals. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the defense.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just briefly to clarify, Carson was clear that the lack of an objection by the defense counsel during the trial is not a fatal flaw in terms of aggravation under 1001b4. Pending any further questions from the bench, Appellant has no further questions.
What was your response to the government's prejudice argument?
In terms of whether or not the appellant was prejudiced?
Right. I think it said limiting instruction and trial counsel didn't hammer it.
Your Honor, I disagree with that argument. It's clear during the trial counsel's argument, during the trial counsel's closing argument, page 170, you get it, page 174, he references clearly the anti-war material found in the room. He never ties anti-war material still to the offense, but he continuously references anti-war material in the room. The prejudice in that case is clear based on the strong mitigations in this case.
But when you say continuously references, what do you mean by that?
At page 170, Your Honor, record 170, discussing in his argument, the trial counsel discusses finding anti-war material in the
right, but that's, I understand that it says that at 170, but I guess what I'm saying is you say continually references, and the fact that it references it at page 170 is a little bit different than continuously references. I mean, the government's argument, taken in context and being fair, at trial was, he's telling you now that he's sorry that he did this, right, but he left people behind and didn't come back till they were deployed to Iraq. Not punish him because he said, I hate President Bush.
What the government is doing, Your Honor, during that argument at 170 and again at 174, is drawing the members' attention to what was left in the room, to the anti-war, to the expressive material that was left in the room. Not that the appellant ever brought any of the members with him, not the appellant went anywhere because of these.
Thank you, counsel. We thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today. The case is submitted. The court will be in recess until 10:40.
The court stands in recess until 10:40. Thank you.
problems with the